if in the US and Western Europe, the populism is coming from a place of weakness, then the policy response to that has to be very different, right? It has to be to neutralize the factors that lead to that disenfranchisement. And for civil society, it's to recognize the sources of that, right? So what can you do about automation in the US? What can you do about job loss or, you know, retraining for workers? How do you manage the process of cultural diversity, right, or increasing diversity? Whereas in developing countries, it's a very different phenomenon. It's, in a way, trying to strengthen institutions, and civil society needs to focus more on protecting institutions and strengthening them so that, you know, this assertion of power doesn't undermine them.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy in the studios of WPSU on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Jenna Spinelli, and welcome to Democracy Works. Today, guys, we are talking about populism and some of the ways that it has manifested itself around the world and some of the ways that people are pushing back against it.
I thought we already talked about this.
We have.
Yeah, lots of time. We're
it seems to come up pretty frequently.
Yeah, it's a small little thing happening around the world, you know. But joining us, we have with us again, Vinita Yadav. You might remember her. She was on the show last fall. She's an associate professor of political science here at Penn State. And we talked with her last fall all about India. But to say that Vinita is only an expert on India is to sell her short about her knowledge of politics and comparative politics from throughout the world. And she joins us today to talk about, again, some of the ways that populism is manifesting itself and how people are pushing back against it.
Yeah, so what's different with this conversation than others we've had about populism is that with Vinita, you'll be able to go into some of the reactions against populism that we're seeing in countries where populist leaders have taken hold.
Yeah, that's true. And then it's also true that for very, you know, self-interested reasons, we've been focusing on populism as it is manifested primarily, not exclusively, but primarily in the United States and Europe and Great Britain, if you want to call that, now that they're separate again.
Yeah. We did shows on Brazil and India, and so we've been talking about it in other. It might be useful for people to review a little bit populism and why it's considered a threat to liberal democracy.
All right.
And I thought maybe the place to start is by, you know, just going over, we've talked about this before, but it's probably useful to talk about it a little bit again, about what we mean when we talk about a liberal democracy.
Oh, I see. Start there and then talk about populism.
Yeah, that because I think it becomes easier to understand why populism is kind of a threat when you first lay out that liberal democracy contains various elements. I mean, one element being this notion, right, of democracy that we all think about when we think about democracy, majoritarianism, that lots of decisions are made with public input and that majority rule holds.
Right, right.
And then also related to it is this idea of liberalism with a small L, not the big L, but, you know, liberalism in the classic sense of that there are, how do I put this, there are spheres of your life that are out of reach of government, that you are free to speak, you're free to assemble, you have various freedoms.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? And the government is
to use
there.
The Declaration of Independence.
Right.
But if you use the Constitution, you have the Bill of Rights, which are a series of constraints on government.
Right. Government is meant to secure these rights, not to, you know, make sure you have them, not take them away.
Right. Yeah. Think about populism. And the reason I think that populism kind of confuses people as to why it's considered a threat to liberal democracy is that it really does emphasize the majoritarianism and the democracy end of things. I mean, it takes deeply the idea that the majority should rule, or at least that the people should rule. I mean, it differs in how it defines the people.
I think you can find some of the reasons why populism is appealing to people in some of those features you just mentioned, right? So when you talk about the people, it is one thing to talk about that as literally everybody, and it's another thing to talk about some subset that is more the people than the other subset.
And even in the American system, at the very beginning, the framers had built up some notion of this, and there's a part in Federalist 2 that's not often talked about.
Ooh, I don't think we've talked about Federalist 2
on the
show before.
We have not, because we don't often talk about Federalist 2, because it's not really that consistent with the sort of multicultural, diverse country that's built up since that time. But in Federalist 2, they wrote, "Providence has been pleased to give this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, very similar in their manners and customs. That's from our Federalist Papers. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to this sort of populist notion of an us against them, that there are these, you know, I mean, right there, they're sort of defining that in the American case, you've got this one people and they're all kind of the same and therefore with a similar interest.
I think it is. I would be willing to bet that there's not a populist movement in the history of the world that doesn't define itself as appealing to the real Hungarians, the real Indians, the real America.
You know, I think maybe what we should do is to listen to Vanita about what's going on in a couple of different countries, several different countries, and then maybe come back and speak in more general terms about what the different approaches might be to countering populism, what we're seeing in those countries, what we might see in some other countries.
That sounds good.
Right. Sounds good. Here is my interview with Vanita Yadav. This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Vanita Yadav. Vanita, thank you for joining us again on Democracy Works for the second time.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me back.
So we are going to talk today about some of the pushback that we've been seeing around the world to populism and some of the kind of anti-democratic forces in a couple of different countries, India, Turkey, and Brazil specifically. But before we get to that, you know, last time we had you on the show back in the fall, we talked all about the state of democracy in India and the rise of Narendra Modi and his BJP party. I would certainly encourage listeners to go back and check that episode out. But for folks who haven't, can you just quickly remind us of what the BJP is and why it is perceived as a threat to liberal democracy in India?
Sure. So the BJP, or the Bharatiya Janata Party, is a religious party. It is nationalist. Economically, its position has varied from being protectionist to being pro-market over time. It's sort of the latest incarnation in a long list of religious political parties in India. It was established in the 1980s. And then starting in the 1990s, it has started forming governments in India. And they just did something unusual, which is they won their first back-to-back elections earlier last year in May 2019. And the reason that they are being perceived as a very serious threat to liberal democracy in India is because they have an agenda which does not endorse liberal values when it comes to civil liberties, including, for example, freedom of speech, treatment of religious minorities, treatment of women, freedom of religion. And they have increasingly pursued this agenda through government institutions, through government policies, by using government funding. And since their victory last year, this sort of trend has become more and more pronounced. And the last time we spoke, I think there were protests were just beginning to start, which were pushing back against their latest policy, which is sort of the sophisticated effort to try and strip as many Muslim citizens of their citizenship, or at least lay the groundwork so this could be an ongoing process for the next few decades.
And so as you started to mention, now we are seeing protests in the country. It seems like they've maybe started toward the end of last year and have certainly continued now into the new year. Can you tell us about who's coming out into the streets? What's motivating them? What do they see themselves as fighting for?
So the BJP basically is trying this two-step process where they basically said, let's create a Citizenship Amendment Act. And this would basically allow illegal immigrants who have been in India from neighboring countries like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, who are not Muslims, to apply for citizenship. And Muslim refugees or illegal immigrants who are Muslims basically would not be eligible for this. And the then president of the BJP, now Home Minister of the Government of India and various other ministers, spoke at public rallies basically saying this was step one. And, step two would be requiring people to show their citizenship in order to be part of this database. And so they articulated at rallies this idea that this was going to complete the process of disenfranchising a lot of Muslims. And the law was passed because they have numbers on this side in the lower and the upper chamber at this point. So the law was passed and it has been ratified. So it is in effect now. What they did not expect is that there would be mobilization by non-Muslim groups, that groups across the country would basically start mobilizing and coordinating, and that it wouldn't just be Muslims, it would be all segments of society, it would be, you know, again, across all regions, across all socioeconomic classes. And so it's got them by surprise. But what has happened is the protests began with protests at this sort of very reputable university in New Delhi called the Jamia Millia University. And it's they have a lot of Muslim students. And initially, the protest was led by Muslim and non-Muslim students from Jamia. But then that got covered and it got picked up. And it began this contagion of protests. So now there have been protests by universities that are among, you know, the most prestigious engineering colleges, the most prestigious business schools, you know, liberal arts colleges, all kinds of colleges, private, government, and in states that have been ruled by the BJP as well as states that are ruled by the opposition. And these protests have been reinforced by a lot of citizen support. So it's not just students. You know, there are trade unions and teachers' unions and physicians and all kinds of people who are coming out both as organizations and as individuals to support sort of the specific, you know, to oppose the specific bill, but then to oppose the agenda and to very clearly call out the BJP and say, this is your agenda.
And what's the BJP's reaction been to these efforts?
So it's been multi-pronged. So part of the sort of the damage management has been to say, well, there is no two-step process. This is really just about giving protection to persecuted religious minorities. And, you know, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Bangladesh are Muslim-majority countries. So Muslims cannot be persecuted in these countries. So we are not discriminating against Muslims. We're just protecting who is persecuted. And there are, of course, lots of counterexamples to that with, you know, Muslim refugees from Burma and Sri Lanka and Ahmadis who are persecuted in Pakistan because they're not considered Muslims by sort of mainstream Sunni Muslims. So that was one aspect of it. The second aspect has been to label protesters as anti-patriotic, people who want to divide India into pieces, and people who have possibly been shipped in from Pakistan.
So let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about Turkey. You know, Erdogan there is often considered as part of this rise in populist authoritarian type of leaders, along with Bolsonaro in Brazil and Orban in Hungary. But I think they've just had elections in Turkey pretty recently. So what happened there as far as Erdogan and his party are concerned?
So the most recent elections were the 2019 municipal and mayoral elections. And then 2018 is when they had the parliamentary and presidential elections. And even in the parliamentary and presidential elections, the AKP, the ruling party, won, but with a lower vote share. And Erdogan won the presidency clear. And now that it's a true presidential system, the powers of parliament are much, much more limited. But what happened this year was in March, April, they had the mayoral elections. And because Turkey is not federal, these are the next most significant subnational elections. And for the first time since the AKP has been in power, and since 2003, a lot of these big cities flipped. And so Istanbul, of course, is the banner case. But Ankara and Antalya, which were controlled by the AKP, have shifted to the CHP, which is sort of the center-left secular party that used to be in power when Turkey was a dictatorship. And so they have won these seats. And so it's, you know, and the vote share again has dropped compared to previous elections. And Istanbul, of course, became a test case for whether the AKP would go full dictatorship or whether they would accept a loss. So the AKP challenged the results, the elections were redone, and in fact, the margin of victory went up. And so that has been taken as a sign that even conservative sort of supporters of the AKP, who are more moderate and who are more committed to democracy, did not like sort of this action that an electoral loss was not accepted. And the CHP actually won in Erdogan's own district within Istanbul. So even conservative neighborhoods, in a way, supported democracy, right? So it's, you know, a lot of people take that as a very positive sign. The fact that Erdogan did not challenge everything else is also taken as a positive sign. But there are deeper concerns that there might be efforts to undermine the electoral process in Turkey now because of these results.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it strikes me that, you know, Erdogan is certainly going to be interested in keeping the power that he has. And you know, I'm wondering the seats, the positions that were picked up in 2019. I mean, how much of a check can they provide on Erdogan and kind of his party, the stake in power that it still has, again, at that kind of federal level?
So they don't really have that much power in terms of checking the president. What they do have is their symbolic power, right? There is feasibility, the ability to demonstrate that this is possible, that you can beat the AK Bey, even in Ankara, even in Istanbul. Right. That is very, very important because this has been one of the big worries in Turkey, that there really is no party that has enough of a following that they can seriously challenge the AK Bey. So that, I think, has been that's a big influential thing that these cities can do and that these mayors can do. The third thing they can do is demonstrate governance. If they, you know, Turkey is another country that is going through an economic slump. And if you look from 2003 to 2008, Turkey was booming. It was doing really well. And after the 2008 crisis, you know, like a lot of other countries, it shrunk. But then it sort of rebounded, but then not to the same extent. And so there are a great deal of economic concerns about, you know, Turkey's future. And one of the things that mayors could do is show initiative in sort of managing economic issues, you know, adopting incentives that kickstart growth, and having relatively corruption-free administrations. So again, it's the ability to demonstrate that we are electable. If you elect us, this is how we are going to govern, right? And that's a very powerful thing.
So I think the last country we want to talk about before we try to tie all these threads together is Brazil. We did an episode on Brazil about this time last year that we'll link in the show notes. But, you know, Brazil has had this long history of kind of oscillating back and forth between democratic style of government and more kind of authoritarian or, you know, military types of ruling forces. And we obviously saw Bolsonaro come into power in 2018, and you know we talked a lot about that the last time. But what are we seeing there? Are some of these signs where people that are pro democracy are coming forward? Is that playing itself out in Brazil?
So I mean, Brazil is, you know, again, if you look at two things in Brazil, which is what has changed in its economy. And Brazil is, I think, still in recession technically. So they have really not been able to recover from the subprime crisis. So the economy has really been on a very clear, steady decline in Brazil. Corruption has been a very high-profile issue, right? And that has tainted all of the mainstream parties. And what's interesting about Bolsonaro is that unlike Modi or Erdogan, he did not have his party backing him. This is someone who hopped to a new party just to run for the presidency. Right. So it's substantively a very different kind of regime in that sense. The other thing that's really changed in Brazil is the growth of the evangelical movement over the last 20, 30 years. So, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it was a predominantly Roman Catholic country. Today, 30% of the population is evangelical, and they are very well mobilized churches who own television and radio and, you know, and have massive followings, and they are very involved in politics. So there is now a set of Christian parties who don't do very well. So 2018 is the first time that one of them has done somewhat well. But they are providing sort of a very similar kind of backbone as the RSS does to the BJP. So in Brazil, what you're seeing again is that there is an institutional backbone to Bolsonaro's party. And by the way, he just formed a new party in November. So, you know, and they're allying with him as a person rather with the party. So in that way, he's in a weaker situation, I think, compared to these other leaders. And that would make it easier for other challengers. But I think a lot depends on his performance. I mean, this is very new. Unlike Erdogan or Modi, he has no economic credentials. There has been no economic boom under him. And so he really has to establish his credentials first for, I think, him to be seen as a serious threat. So now whether his type of persona is a threat, right, whether if it's not Bolsonaro, there could be another, that I think is more viable. There could be, you know, a more well-established figure within Brazilian politics who could come up and win in the future or could mobilize in the future with, again, allying with these churches. So I think Brazil is still, to me, it's still an open case. But the worrisome side is that compared to India or Turkey, there is less support for democracy in Brazil, actually, if you look at public opinion surveys, right? So, and surprisingly, a larger sort of demand for a role for religion in you know, in government than Turkey or India, which is not what you would expect a priority. So there are some, I think, more worrying long-term trends that suggest that maybe Bolsonaro, if not Bolsonaro, someone else. If the economy does well, I think some of that support could switch back, in fact, to some of the other parties. But if the economy does poorly, it depends on whether it's going to be another Bolsonaro-like politician or whether people do switch back. But there hasn't been the same kind of pushback, and I think the support for something like that seems larger in Brazil at this point.
We're seeing a lot of these kind of populist movements spring up in, you know, even in places like Italy and Germany and kind of spreading throughout Europe. We've talked about, you know, Turkey and India as two kind of bright spots, as you've described, or, you know, places where civil society really is starting to come out and try to move the needle on these things. Are there lessons that other countries can take from what's happening there about kind of the ways to push back against some of these populist forces?
I mean, so the lesson would seem to be that civil society really is the force that can sort of, you know, try and take this challenge on. But I think we want to be careful about transferring lessons from these countries, because populism is rising, in my opinion, from very different roots. So, you know, in if you look at, you know, the arguments for why populism has come up in Western Europe or in the US, it's about, you know, cultural backlash and, you know, how economic sort of grievances are reinforcing that. But in a lot of developing countries, like the three we've talked about, in fact, economic growth has reinforced the, you know, the middle class and the religious conservatives. And so that populism is not coming from a place of weakness. It's coming from a place of strength as an assertion of, you know, we are the ones who have benefited from globalization. And now we, you know, we would like to see the national identity reflect our identity, as opposed to the U.S. and Western Europe, where it's very much people who, you know, the argument is people who feel disenfranchised by these changes and by globalization. They are the ones who are pushing back. So they're very different dynamics, right? And because of that, who can respond and which segment of civil society can respond has to be different, I think. So in these countries, you know, if populism is, if in the U.S. and Western Europe, the populism is coming from a place of weakness, then the policy response to that has to be very different, right? It has to be to neutralize the factors that lead to that disenfranchisement. And for civil society, it's to recognize the sources of that, right? So what can you do about automation in the U.S.? What can you do about job loss or, you know, retraining for workers? How do you, you know, sort of manage the process of cultural diversity, right, or increasing diversity. Whereas in developing countries, it's a very different phenomenon. It's in a way trying to strengthen institutions, and civil society needs to focus more on protecting institutions and strengthening them so that, you know, this assertion of power doesn't undermine them, right? So I think the policy responses have to be different. Perhaps the actors have to be civil society in both cases, but the responses need to be very different, because I think the problems are coming from very different places.
So you mentioned before kind of this difference between populism that comes from a place of weakness versus a place of strength. How does that, if at all, change how these populists relate to how they perceive liberal democracy and everything that comes with it?
So, I mean, it's linked to, one, their capacity to make things happen, right? So if you're coming from a place of strength, So in Turkey and India, for example, the religious conservative middle class has gained from globalization, has become more prosperous, right? And they have taken this money and they have strengthened these religious organizations who have then fanned out into all kinds of social and economic organizations, right? So their capacity to mobilize people, their capacity to, you know, provide campaign finance and get out the vote outfits is very different in terms of the sheer numbers and the wealth and the assets that are backing this, right? Whereas in the U.S., there is a lot of street power, right? But I think because the media in the U.S. and in Western Europe is more free, right, is privately owned and is more free, and the courts are stronger, there's less space in a way to use these assets. And then the population that is actually supporting these populists are not as sort of asset rich as I would say the populists who are supporting, you know, the citizens who are supporting populist movements in the developing world. So there is a difference in capacity, and I think that difference in capacity translates into differences in tactics, right? And that's why I think where these weaknesses show up, where the attacks show up, are going to be different, and that's why their durability is different. So you would expect it to be more sustained in countries where it's the people who have benefited and have the assets to back up their efforts. Whereas in the U.S. and Western Europe, I think it's a more optimistic picture in the sense that because they're relatively speaking asset poor, the segments of society that are not populist have, you know, are suffering from a lower asset deprivation. And then, you know, they can sort of challenge them more successfully.
Right. But also, I mean, being cognizant of the fact that they have more assets. I mean, I think just saying that, oh, we already have more power, we have more money, we've benefited more from globalization, et cetera, that kind of helps even fuel the populist notion even more in the U.S. at least anyway. So I think having that being cognizant of these different factors also seems like it's important.
Yeah, and I think that's why the way to tackle this, what you need to do has to be different because of that, because they're showing up in different places. They will, you know, one might be more sustained in a longer fight, the other might be a shorter duration, hopefully.
So, Vanita, this has been very eye-opening, I think, especially in an election year in the U.S. It's easy to forget about or ignore what's happening in other parts of the world. So thank you for joining us today to help shed some light.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
So it was very, very interesting. Not surprising that Vanita is able to speak comfortably about India as well as some other developing countries.
A lot more comfortably than either of us.
Yeah, well. That's why she's an associate professor of comparative politics,
exactly.
And we're not.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It is striking how different the story is from the story that that you would use to describe Brexit or Hungary or even the United States. In some ways, and yet in some ways, it's very similar, right?
Right. I mean, the thing when you're looking across different countries, I mean, including the U.S. and some of these other countries, is that this sort of populist reaction and populist counter-reaction is going to take some different forms. But there are also some common patterns. I think that one thing that we're seeing, certainly in India, and I think she described this as well in Turkey, is protest and reaction to some of the actions that have been taken against liberal democracy.
Are we talking about, the original populist movement? And
so, I mean, that's very important because what's happening there is distinguishing between policy differences and threats to what people perceive as threats to the legitimacy of the regime. By the regime, I mean democracy.
Democracy, sure.
But there are also other ways to address populism that you might see as more relevant? And Vanita actually drew this distinction between developed and undeveloped countries.
Well, but it's still, I mean, what I found interesting, especially about India, was, you know, there is this kind of populist argument, and it may appeal to economics, it may appeal to culture, but it argues, you know, this idea that you resentful, unhappy person, you're the true patriot. You're the real American, real Indian, whatever. And what struck me about the protest, the way she described the protests in India, was that they were appealing, or they were represented by people from all walks of life, right? All classes, all segments of society. And so if that's true, and if you can have a protest that is that widespread, then you undercut the claim that we are the people, or the people who support the populists are the people. Because, no, quite clearly, we are the people who are protesting are the people. And so once you undermine that claim, then it becomes more difficult to sustain populism, or, you know, because it always references that. It always rests on the idea that there is an us and a them, and the us is better. Us has a better claim to identity and to rule.
Yeah, that's a good point about how those protests are effective. I mean, I think that in the U.S., along with some other developed countries, which is a distinction that she was trying to draw, I think that the issue of how to address populism is probably somewhat different than it is in these underdeveloped, less developed countries, which is what she was trying to explain. And I mean, in these developed countries, if we take what Vanita was saying as, you know, a reasonable characterization, I think it was that the populism is more cultural. You know, it's probably traced more to these massive changes in what the country looks like, that the country is becoming more multicultural, that it's becoming less white in the case of the United States.
And more secular.
And yes, and more secular, that these are all sort of cultural threats. And these are, you know, I'm not quite sure that just these sorts of protests are the way to address those sorts of issues. You know, when Andrew Sullivan was here, he was making the point that I've seen in other places as well, that, you know, Democrats, if they really want to address the rise of populism, need to start talking seriously about immigration. In other words, recognizing that the kind of populist claims to a sort of national sovereignty are legitimate to
right.
many people.
So that's a pretty nuanced argument as well. So your point is that national sovereignty is the feeling that that's undermined by immigration. And when you say sovereignty, you're really talking about national identity,
right?
A sense of who we are and what makes us distinctive and what we value as a people. Well, and it also speaks to just how up for grabs or unsettled the world is, not just in terms of economics and immigration, but also just in terms of the rate of change culturally as well, right?
Yeah, but I also think that we shouldn't devalue the role of economics, even if these sorts of populism are culturally
totally
driven.
Agree.
Because inequality has certainly contributed to the mm-hmm. sense that people have that others are taking from them.
Well, and others are winning, even though there's nothing legitimate about, you know, I'm doing everything I should be doing. I'm playing by the rules. I'm working hard. I just want to support my family, and I'm not able to. And you, A, are able to, and B, you look down your nose at me. And resentment is an incredibly powerful force. I mean, it's in terms of motivating political will and power. And so, yeah, you see that. Vanita's talked about this, you know, position of strength from in India and some other countries. And I'm not quite clear on, you know, there still has to be some kind of resentment. Otherwise, there's no real reason for populism.
Well, I think what Vanita is offering us, and we'll probably need more of this, is that here's sort of a model of countering populism and restoring democracy, potentially, in some countries. There are applications that we can use for other countries, but populism is diverse. And we need to think broadly about how it's going to be responded to effectively.
My thought is that there is this bargain that's implicit in any populist movement, and the way you address populism is by undercutting the features of that bargain. And that can mean addressing the reasons for resentment. That can mean undermining the claim to people. Whatever it is, making government more efficient, whatever it is, you cannot fail. You're not going to succeed unless you take the reasons for populism seriously. And that's basically what you've been saying.
Yeah.
Well, thanks to Vinita for yet another really good interview. Thanks to Jenna. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Chris Beam.
I'm Michael Berkman.
This has been Democracy Works.
Democracy Works is produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU Penn State, Central Pennsylvania's NPR station. Andy Grant is our engineer, and our editors are Mark Stitzer and Chris Kugler. Additional support comes from Ann Danahay, Emily Reddy, Shireen Stanford, Craig Johnson, and the rest of the team at WPSU. For more information on this episode and detailed show notes, visit our website at democracyworkspodcast.com. And if you like what you heard today, please leave us a rating or review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.